So I know we live in a society that really does. I don't know if it's unintentional or intentional. It's just the dynamic of life is death. And I don't know how else to say it, but we watch so many TV shows that are about death, whether it's like Law and Order, you know, where you're trying to solve the crime. I noticed even last night some of the shows, you know, I've watched a number of series and I'm sitting there looking for something new to watch. And there's a category of murder mysteries, you know, and it's just what we do as a society. We kind of dwell on these things. I don't know that we wake up every day thinking, you know what, I'm going to dwell on death today. But we do. It is the framework of all of our lives, and we understand this. We don't really dwell on it, but at the same time, we know it's coming. And I think this is honestly one of the difficulties about coming to church anyway, is we're coming together, and even though we may not focus on it, it is at some point something that is going to be mentioned, that we're all going to die. And how thrilling is that, you know, that every week is like, okay, here comes another message of we're going to die. And we're going to die. We're going to die. We're going to die. Yes, we are. And we know it. We pass by a cemetery. If you drive on Taft, you know, just on the other side of 441, you pass a pretty good-sized cemetery. And I do on occasion think of it as my resting place. I don't know. You know, it's just, there it is. It's the way of people. It's just life. We know that. Job had to deal with this in Job chapter 14. And he makes the point in verse 7 of chapter 14 that there is more hope for a tree. That was his assessment. And we know the story of Job in general. And the idea that he's kind of minding his own business, it seems. God brings him up to Satan. And Satan says the only reason he's an upright and righteous guy is you're protecting him. If you hadn't put a hedge around him, he wouldn't be this way. But let me at him. And he goes after all of his children. He kills all of his children. He takes away, it sounds like, all of his possessions. And it's his wife who's left who says, you know, it looks like God hates you. You might as well curse him and die. Well, she lost as much, if not more, because she's having to deal with a grieving husband who she has at that time no right the way he does. But Job has three friends who come and they sit with him for a week and don't say one word, it seems. And they do good for that week. Now, after that week, they start responding. Because I know what probably happened. They sat there for the week and they listened to Job talk. And Job's point was, why would something this real bad happen to someone good like me? Do bad things happen to good people? That's really the question. Now, he says it in a lot of different ways, but that's the essence of Job's question. Do good people suffer? And I think most of us are like the three friends. Only bad people suffer. Wicked things happen to wicked people. Good things happen to good people. And Job turns that entire thing upside down and says, no, bad things just happen to everybody. Whether you're wicked or good, you're going to suffer something. I mean, this morning as we're going through our announcements, we're like, yeah. And I don't know that anybody would sit back and go, well, that person deserves it, and that person doesn't. We're not thinking that way. These are all righteous people, you know, striving for good things, and they're suffering. Thankfully, not like Job, but they are suffering. And for some, it may not be, you know, the great outcome that they really would like and all. And we talk about those things, but not so out loud, I know. In Job 14, the context of the chapter is Job is despondent. He expresses, I think, hopelessness to some degree in this chapter. He's frustrated. It's not just the fact that bad things happen to good people. It's him sitting back and kind of looking and thinking and going, if you think about it, there's more hope for a tree than there is for a person. The human condition is certainly one of suffering, but how do we deal with it? That's really the question that Job is trying to get to. How do we deal with it in a way that satisfies us and glorifies God? I think in a big picture way, this is the question. It's not just how do we deal with it, but how do we deal with it where we are satisfied and God is glorified? And ultimately, Job does that. Job satisfies himself. And you know how he does? By not satisfying himself. God shows up, and in the way God shows up toward the end of the book is in a tornado. We read whirlwind, and whirlwind sounds fun to me. Whirlwind, woo, you know. Tornado is really the essence of the idea of this storm that comes. And God, out of the storm, talks to Job and says, I've been hearing a lot of things. Who is this wise man? I'd like to ask you some questions. And he lays it on Job. Basically, Job, you're not me. I am me. And I've got it all under control. Just because you don't understand it doesn't mean it's not under control. And just because you don't get it doesn't mean the right thing isn't going to happen. Job is a wise man, and Job's response essentially is, woe is me, I am wrong to have asked these questions this way, and he repents. His three friends are then rebuked by God for not helping, because they came up with all kinds of different ideas that essentially boil down to bad things happen to bad people. Job, you're bad. That's why bad things happen. In your Bible, I'd like for you to read with me in Romans chapter 8. Romans 8, and I want to start at verse 18. Sorry. Here we go. Romans 8, 18. A great section here in the book of Romans. We know 8:28 that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love Him. It's not just that God causes all things, and there's the period. It's God causes all things to work together for good. The storms of life bring good. And so as we start at verse 18, Paul is saying this, that I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing. Notice it's not, he doesn't just say don't compare it. He says there's no worth, there's no value in comparing the sufferings of this present time with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, but not willingly, but because of Him who subjected it in hope that the creation itself will be set free. Now he's going all the way back to the beginning in Genesis chapter 3, when God curses the ground because of Adam. And he tells Adam, you came out of the dirt, you're going back to the dirt. But in the meantime, you're going to have to work hard to get your food. And I know you and I are thinking, well, yeah, but Adam didn't have to work hard for his food. His food apparently was just there. He had access constantly. There was no worry, no nothing. There was no danger. There was not a moment that Adam would have to think, today might be the day I die. Because he had no absolute concept of that at all. There was no sense of that. He had been told, don't eat this tree because you're going to die. But I don't think Adam was like, oh yeah, I'm going to die. I know what that means. Because I don't think he did. And now God is saying the ground is cursed. The ground didn't do anything wrong. Why is the ground getting cursed? Because of Adam. And so Paul says that the creation, the earth itself, is waiting for the revealing of the sons of God. It wants to be released from this. That it was subjected to, but not willingly. It didn't sign up for that. But because of Him who subjected it in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth till now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit, we groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for the adoption of sons. And he tells us what that is, the redemption of our bodies. Now, in a different context, 1 Corinthians 15, he talks about the glory of that body. And it's an amazing discussion. You know, there were those in Corinth who didn't believe in the resurrection. And so when Paul gets to the point of making the, I think, philosophical argument about it, the question is, what body are we going to have? And he says, that's kind of a dumb question. And his point is, look at the world that we live in. You plant a seed in the ground, the harvest is not what you see the seed is. I mean, I use the watermelon because to me it's just still fascinating. I don't like watermelon, but I like using the illustration because you got a little flat black seed and you put it in the ground and out comes this bulbous green striped thing. I mean, bulbous, like, you know, huge sometimes. Cut it open and it's red and it's filled with these seeds if you have one of those kind, you know, because they now have seedless watermelon. And it's an amazing thing. That seed did that, yes. And Paul's point as he goes through 1 Corinthians 15 is what you plant is not what you're going to reap. And here's the point. The body that we plant into the ground is not going to be the one that is reaped. We're not told anything about that body except it's immortally arrayed. It's not going to be like the one we have here now. And I can't give you any sort of Bible to say this is how it's described because we aren't given a description. But that's what Paul is saying here. We groan inwardly because we want to be adopted as sons, which that means the redemption of our body. In this hope, we were saved. Hope of what? The redemption of our bodies. We talk about all our aches and pains. We even talked a little bit about that Wednesday night, talking about the fruit of the Spirit and the characteristic of long-suffering. Long-suffering means we suffer long, you know, and if you live as a human being, you're going to suffer. It's just life under the sun. Whether you're a good person or a bad person, you are going to suffer. It is life. And yet, the hope that we have, and the hope we're saved in, according to verse 24, is the hope of the redemption of our bodies. Now, hope that is seen isn't hope. You don't hope for things you don't see. You know, or you rather, he says, you know, let me read this right and say it right. Hope that is seen is not hope. So if you realize this, like a person who says, I one day want to get married, and you're like, you are married, you have kids, you have, oh, one day I hope to get married. You have that. You know, how is that? I mean, that's just the sense of it. Paul says you don't hope for things you are already experiencing. Who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we don't see, are we waiting? Then we're waiting for it with patience. Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we don't know what to pray for as we should. But the Spirit himself intercedes for us with groanings that are too deep for words. He who searches hearts knows what the mind of the Spirit is, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to God's will. And we know that. Notice his terminology here isn't we kind of wish for or hope for even. He says we know that those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. Now that's New Testament theology. Old Testament is Job. There's more hope for a tree. A tree can fall and die, and even after a little while, the scent of water, he describes it that way, a little green twig plugs out. How does that happen? It has more hope than us. Just for the sake of time, we don't have time because of the way I got this, but if you'll read Job 14, it's depressing in one way, because it is like, you know, you kind of sit there thinking, yeah, Job is asking the right questions, he's making the right statements, but it also comes with hope as you go through that. What comes next? Well, in Isaiah 55, what comes next is the concept of God's thoughts being higher than ours. This is the passage that Ken had read to us earlier, his ways. Everything is different from the perspective of God. It's not our perspective. And I know people get bogged down in our own perspective. God says his is different and it's better. He sees, not just because he's God, it's the sense of, yes, he is God, but he has better intentions for us even than we have for ourselves. One of the questions I sometimes try to ask people when I'm studying with them about things like this, and I can say this just because I feel that way. My dad, years ago, had sold life insurance, and it was, I think, one of the toughest jobs he ever had because he would complain that he had to try to convince young people they're going to die. And you have a hard time convincing young people they're going to die, you know? They don't think about it then. I don't know when it is. I'm sure there have been studies about it, that when do we start really thinking about the end of our lives? I can tell you, you know, I haven't really started dwelling on it until I had my heart attack, you know? That was as close as I really had ever gotten in my life. I've been in, you know, motorcycle things where guys come close to hitting me. I still don't think about death, really. You just don't. But, yeah, then I did. I felt like I was facing it down, you know? Okay, now what? I think about it a whole lot more than I ever did before, just because of the experience of my life in that way. And sometimes that's what it takes, is to kind of wake you up to do that. But the question is, what comes next? And you can talk to a young person. As a preacher, I feel like a life insurance agent sometimes. You're talking to somebody, and they're like, I'm living my life now, and I'll get to a point where I settle down when I'm 30 or 40, when I'm really old. And you're like, okay, 30, 40 is not really old. Oh, I wish, you know, we all start doing that. Oh, I remember that. Oh, yeah, okay. But even at 55, I know technically I read in the newspaper the obituaries and read about somebody who's 55, and I'm like, dude, that's my age. I don't want to die now. I feel like I have a little while longer to go. And the older you get, I'm sure it's that way. It's a perspective, isn't it? You know, my dad, I think he's 78. I'd have to pull out a calculator to do all the math. But, you know, I can think of him as old. He doesn't think of himself as old. I think sometimes he should, because he's doing things. I'm like, what are you doing? He's like, well, I still feel young. Part of the problem is, I was talking to him the other day, he has been spending time with his sister. And his sister's 3 years older than him, but she's a very energetic sort of person. So she's 81, he's 78. And, you know, they feel like kids when they're together. And I'm like, y'all don't need to do that. You don't need to get yourselves in some kind of trouble just because you feel young, you know. Look in a mirror, Dad. You don't look young. You're not young. But we all understand this is life, and we have no guarantees of living 60, 70 years. You know, Moses said in Psalm 90, if by reason of strength, right? And that's kind of general. I mean, he lived to be over 100, you know, 120. It's the point that we know there is finality in life. What comes next? Well, I'm in school. I've got to do school. What comes next? Work. And maybe I have a family. And you know, you go through and you're like, what's next? And then I retire. Well, what's next? Well, then I enjoy my grandkids, you know, and what's next? You keep pushing somebody to the next step. What's next? And finally, and it's been like a eureka moment for some of them. What's next? I guess I die. What's next? Yeah, it's not an easy thought. I know some people want to say, well, we die, we're just dead. That's why the world is so frustrated, because this life makes no sense. That you live a life and then you just die and that's it. And you're only here for a little while, super little while. God gives us hope, and that's what we're talking about here in Romans 8. And Job, you know, kind of philosophically asking about the hope that a tree has better hope than us. As we read here in Hebrews 9, the reminder from the New Testament is, it is appointed for man to die once. Well, that's what I was referencing in Genesis 3, when God spoke to Adam and told him that what he had did was wrong. And to Adam he said, because you've listened to the voice of your wife, you've eaten the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you will eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns, thistles shall it'll bring forth for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. You are dust, and to dust you shall return. God doesn't say, Adam, you're made out of dust and you might return. He says, you are going to return. And that's the way it is for all of us. Paul uses the imagery here, and he says in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 47 through 50, that the first man, talking about Adam, was from the earth, a man of dust. The second man is from heaven, talking about Jesus. As was the man of dust, so also are those who are of the dust. And just as is the man of heaven, so also are those who are of heaven. Just as we have borne the image or carry the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the man of heaven. I tell you this, brothers, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does the perishable inherit the imperishable. Now, we don't know exactly what all that means. If you read in Ezekiel chapter 1, 2, you have descriptions of these angelic beings that sound really weird. They sound like aliens to me. I mean, when you read it, it's like, man, this is weird. The way their feet are, the way their arms are. It's just strange. And, you know, I really do think whatever it is that we think heaven's going to be like, it's not going to be anything close. I don't think at all it's going to be anything close. I don't think it's wrong for us to kind of think about it. Because even like in Revelation 21, 22, he describes things in a way that we can get. Streets made out of gold, you know. And you're like, I understand that. That's why he says it this way, for us to be attracted to the idea, certainly, of it. But what it is going to be exactly, I don't know. I mean, even in Revelation, you read about these elders who are casting crowns constantly, singing praise to God, the four living creatures. They're not like any creatures, really, that we have here on earth now at all. So it's just, we don't know. But I'll be honest with you, I want to know, want to find out, want to know what it is. Don't want to miss out on that at all. And so Paul, in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 16 to 18, he says this as he's writing to the Corinthians. He says, we do not lose heart. We're not going to give up. And he's been talking in a few verses before, like verse 7, about this treasure of the gospel in jars of clay. That's our bodies. He says, we don't lose heart, even though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. Same phrasing, pretty much, that you find in Romans 8:18. It's beyond all comparison as we look not to the things that we see, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are temporal, the things that are unseen are eternal. Now we know this. I think academically we know this. I'm not saying we know this from experience. We know this academically. We read these passages. We're like, yeah, this is what it is. In chapter 5, he starts talking about the body that we have is a tent. The body we're going to get from God is like a building made not with hands, eternal in the heavens. I don't know what all that means other than the aspect of it is it's eternal. It's not mortal the way we are. And, you know, some more quickly with mortality than others. At the end of his section there, 2 Corinthians 5, verse 9 and 10, he says, whether we're at home or away, which means whether we're living or dead, we make it our aim to please Him. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. That's not a thing that people really want to focus on, but that's the truth that the Bible tells us of a reality of judgment. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he's done in the body, whether good or evil. Jesus references this. This is the passage that we'll close with in John 5, verse 28-29. Because Jesus talks about being able to raise himself from the dead. It's later in chapter 6 that he makes it very clear. I lay down my life and I can take it up again. Nobody else can really say anything like that. We can say those words but not mean those words. He can do it. John 5, 28-29, do not marvel at this. For an hour is coming when all who are in the tombs will hear his voice and come out. Doesn't matter how long you talk to a cemetery, ain't nobody coming out. Not unless they're just sleeping, hiding behind something. I have read of a story that happened. There was a fella, and he was working at the cemetery. He was one of the diggers. You know, they use machines now to dig to a certain point, and then they kind of finesse the whole thing, the whole. And he was one of those finessers. He's digging with a shovel, making it nice and perfectly rectangular, fitting everything. And after a little while, he was tired, thought he'd eat a little snack and eat. Didn't realize that one of the other guys was in the hole next to him. And the guy next to him, I guess, as he was taking a little bit of a nap, stood up, said, "Hey, is anybody out there?" And scared this guy nearly to death. Can you imagine now? Don't expect that, but that happens. Well, it's not going to happen except when Jesus calls. Everyone in the tomb will hear his voice and come out. It's not just that they're going to hear him, they're coming out. Those who've done good to the resurrection of life, and those who've done evil to the resurrection of judgment. And it's a permanent thing. I think this is something else we could talk about, the permanence of it, but how do you illustrate that? My point. The hope that Job referenced about that a tree has. There's more hope for a tree. Job didn't know this, but we, through the New Testament, as we find what Jesus and his apostles are teaching, as we've been reading a lot from Paul today, references the actual hope that we all have of eternal life. And Jesus, as we read there in John 5, makes it clear that life eternal is either in heaven or hell. It's either a resurrection of life or a resurrection of judgment, a resurrection of condemnation, which means it's a forever thing. And I know that's hard because we don't think in forever. Even as we gather together, we're thinking, okay, he's getting ready to wrap up. We're getting ready to go. And then what's next? Lunch, what's next? That's the question. What's next? And I know for all of us, we don't really know exactly what's next. We have ideas of what we think is up next. But the Bible teaches us clearly that it is appointed for men to die once and then comes the judgment. Are you ready for that? You can be. You know, there are some things, there's some bills that you pay that you can set it up where you don't have to think about it ever again. I like that. I like not having to worry with it. You just set it up on your computer and you just go on, you know. And every once in a while you get an email giving you an update of something. But it's nice not to have to worry. What do I have to pay today and all that? I want you to think in some way how that could be related in our thinking about eternity. It's not that we have no more thought about God, but I don't have to worry now. that I've been baptized and had all my sins forgiven. When I sin now, I don't have to be baptized again to go through all that. I can go right to God. I don't need a priest. I don't need somebody else to go through. The high priest is Jesus. I go right to Him. He goes before God the Father on my behalf. All I need to do is pray. That's Acts 8. When Simon the sorcerer, remember, he did that. He wanted to buy the gift of the Holy Spirit. And Peter says, you need to pray. What? You need to pray for forgiveness, that the thought of your heart would be forgiven. And Simon's the one who says, pray for me. Peter doesn't say, you need someone praying for you. He says, you need to pray. You can do that, but only if you've been baptized and born again of water and spirit. The judgment day is coming for everybody. It's not a threat. It's a promise. It's going to happen. Whenever that happens, whether it's today or next week, I know we're thinking much further down the road, all of us are, really. But whenever that time comes, there's no turning back. And it's going to be a permanent relationship with God forever, forever. But you can be ready. You can have confidence in Him, not in you. In you, yeah, who knows which way the wind blows, right? It's in God. Our confidence is in Him and His Son who died for us, who gives us this gift of eternal life. Tonight, Lord willing, we'll talk about what can a man give in exchange for his soul. I want us to think, though, right now, what's next? Because eventually what's next for all of us is standing before God. And we can be ready. You can be ready this morning if you've not been baptized. Everything is set up for it. You can do that now. Come forward, please, right now as we stand and sing.